My name is Rabbi Phil Karish. I work at the OU in the Community and Synagogue Services Department as the Regional Director for the Midwest of the United States. And in particular, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the leadership at the OU, at the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, and YU's Center for the Jewish Future, as we embark today on getting a better understanding and halachic guidance for Rabbanim and community leaders, keeping our community safe amid the coronavirus crisis. As information for those of you who are on the call, if any questions do come up throughout the call, I'd like you to please feel free to email me. I'll say my email address twice so that you'll have the opportunity to write it down. And while I can't promise to answer all of them, we'll certainly make an effort to get the questions to Rabbi Dr. Glad and to Rabbi Willig, and hopefully we'll be able to get to many of them. My email address is karishp, K-A-R-E-S-H-P, as in Purim, at OU.org. Again, that's K-A-R-E-S-H-P, as in Purim, at OU.org. Please feel free to email any questions throughout this call. As well, this call is being recorded, and we will share with the leadership of these three organizations after the call, and they will disseminate accordingly. Today we have the opportunity to hear from Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt and as well Rabbi Mordechai Willig. I will first be hearing from Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt, who is the Associate Rabbi at Congregation Anshei Chesed and the Assistant Rabbi at the Young Israel of Woodmere. As well, he is the Chairman of Medicine and Hospital Epidemiologist at South Nassau Communities Hospital and the Clinical Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He is also a spokesperson for the Infectious Disease Society of America. After Rabbi Dr. Glatt speaks, we will be hearing from Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who is Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, the Rav of the Young Israel of Riverdale, and the Skan Av Bezdin of the Bezdin of America. And without further ado, I'd like to ask Rabbi Dr. Glatt to begin his remarks.
It is a tremendous honor for me to be here with my Rebbe, Rabbi Mordechai Willig Shlita, as well as all the other Rabbanim that are on this call, and to thank the organization as well that have put this together, three organizations that I'm intimately giving Hakara Satov to for what they've done for me. Without any further ado, I want to start off and say that I'm not paskening any shilas over here in the presence of my Rebbe. If it sounds like that, I apologize in advance. Any halachic shila, the Rebbe should, of course, say that, although I will mention halachic issues and say certain things that could be mistakenly thought of as a psak halacha, but the Rebbe has to either correct me if I'm wrong or to address the halachic implications in greater detail. First and most importantly, give a very short background on the novel coronavirus known as COVID-19. I will call it COVID just to make life easier. If I use the term coronavirus, I'm actually referring to COVID. Coronaviruses have been around for a long time, and actually coronaviruses cause the common cold. And there are tests out there today that doctors can order to come back coronavirus. That has absolutely nothing to do with the current novel coronavirus, COVID-19. So this has been a scare sometimes in the medical community that we get calls. That is the common cold, and it is related but totally unrelated for the purposes of this call. So if a patient were to tell you that they had a blood test by their doctor or some other test by their doctor that showed that they had coronavirus, it almost certainly is not this. The only place in New York at the present time that can do coronavirus testing, COVID-19 testing, is the Department of Health Laboratory at Wadsworth upstate. There are other state laboratories across the country. I know people outside of New York State are listening to this call, and the CDC, of course, does testing. At the present time, that is the most important limitation that we have regarding our ability to diagnose coronavirus, because we don't have good testing at this point in time. Emir Tzashem, that will change in the upcoming maybe week or two, and that will allay some of the concerns that people have. I've been exposed to somebody, what should I do, which I'll talk about momentarily. I want to give a very, very brief background on the worldwide data, then I'll give the New York City and the United States data, New York State data actually, but it's mostly New York City or the immediate surrounding area from New York City, and then I'll talk about travel issues, and then I'll try to address some of the main things that shuls should do. So in the world, there have been almost 100,000 reported cases. Lania Zdati, that is at least by a factor of one, times as much. So probably at least 200,000 cases have occurred, in my humble opinion. There is significant underreporting from China. Certainly they weren't looking for mild cases or asymptomatic cases or very, very mild symptomatic cases. And they were focusing on the more serious cases, plus the ability of that country when this first came out to identify and test for cases was very limited. So all the data that's coming out from the world and China has to be taken with that very, very important caveat that it may not be fully accurate. The deaths probably are accurate. And in the United States, worldwide, with 100,000 cases, it probably is 200,000 or 300,000 cases, there have been about 3,000 deaths. If you look at all of the mortality reports that are coming out, they're all very, very difficult to interpret. So I'll say this as a general statement. The mortality of COVID-19 is certainly potentially more than influenza. But one should realize that influenza is a major, serious, potentially fatal, Rahman al-Islam disease with a mortality of about 1 in 1,000. The real number for COVID-19, in my estimation, will probably fall in an area that may be 3 to 5 times higher than that, which would mean 3 to 5 people per 1,000. There are reports out there that suggest that it's much higher than that. Many of these reports are quite skewed, and they actually look at only the very sickest patients. And unfortunately, if you do look at the very sickest patients, they do have a higher mortality rate, and that could be important halacha lemaisa, practical advice for shuls. Older patients, especially those with respiratory illness, and if you specifically look at the China data for people above the age of 80 who have respiratory illness, they have about a 14% mortality rate. That means 14 out of every 100, Rahman al-Islam, will pass away. So that's a very important fact to remember. Baruch Hashem, on the good side, China has had a lot of experience with younger children, and Baruch Hashem, Bli Ayin Hara, to this point in time, not one single child under the age of 10 has died, and they mostly don't have at all serious disease. So a very important take-home message from today's discussion is that children are probably at a very, very low risk. Unfortunately, children who are sicker may be a higher risk, but we don't even know that for certain. But certainly a lot of anxiety. Parents, grandparents, great-grandparents are worried about their little kids. So Bli Ayin Hara, the likelihood of a young child getting into trouble with COVID-19 is very, very low. On the other hand, with influenza, the number of children killed this season in the United States alone from influenza, who've died from influenza, is 125 minimum. So this influenza is a far more serious illness in young children. And everything that I'm saying in terms of prevention eventually applies to influenza just as much, and in some situations more, than for COVID-19. In New York State, and really it's mostly New York City, as of before I started this conference call, and unfortunately things are rapidly changing, so this could be different by the end of the conference call, there were 11 reported cases as of this morning. As of midday, the state announced 2 additional cases, and I know that there are a number of other cases that are awaiting testing results. Most of them seem to revolve around the one case in New Rochelle that was very well publicized, and then 10 contacts that were directly associated with that person. And this will lead me to the next discussion, how contagious is this illness? There are 2 other cases that were identified today in New York City that unfortunately don't have a obvious risk for them. They don't have a travel or a known exposure to a person with COVID-19. They seem to be totally unrelated to the New Rochelle little mini outbreak. And that is, again, a cause for concern. Other states in the United States have about 160 cases right now in the United States, but only under 100 are actually about 80 right now are actually developed in the United States. The other cases in the United States were actually flown in. These were United States citizens were identified as having COVID outside the United States and were brought in under very strict isolation, and none of those cases have transmitted additional cases since then. So how contagious is COVID-19? So there was a report published earlier this week by the CDC in their Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is the, you know, the most prestigious publication for these types of information. And Baruch Hashem, it was extremely positive in terms of that spending a period of time, a significant period of time around a patient with COVID, most of the time did not result in transmission. Only 2 of the first 10 cases that were identified, and they followed up about 450 contacts who by definition were at least by the bedside or within the bed of the patient, within the room of the patient, within 6 feet of the patient for at least 10 minutes, only two of 450 contacts developed COVID. So that is a very, very positive sign. There'll be a publication that will be coming out next week that I had the opportunity to be asked to review, which showed a similar, very, very positive, low rate of transmission in a hospital with transmission among staff and other patients. On the other hand, if you look at the New Rochelle experience, there's been a very high potential transmissibility, as most of the family members of the first index case, as well as then people who had contact with the index case and then their families, did become unfortunately infected. So the exact level of transmissibility remains a little bit unknown. It certainly should be thought of as being a highly contagious disease, but just to allay people's fear, and part of the purpose of this call is really to allay people's fears. In terms of what practically shuls can do, and the single, in my opinion, most important thing is to lower the level of hysteria. There is a pachad, and I don't think that does anybody any good. That's not to say that we should cover up what the real data show, and not to say that we should minimize this. This is potentially a very serious condition, but at the same time, everybody needs to take a very deep breath and realize that this will impact us. The question is how much it will impact us and what we can do to mitigate that impact as much as possible, as is Hashem. So, first and foremost is, I think it's extremely important, and I look forward to Rav Willy Shlita corroborating this and stressing this, that Rabbanim should go from their pulpits and tell people, please do not come to shul if you have respiratory symptoms. If you have a fever and respiratory symptoms, do not come to shul. If you have significant respiratory symptoms, even without a fever, please do not come to shul. A person who has an allergy, and they know that it's an allergy, and how do they know that? That's not easily determined even by a physician. That's a different story. So therefore, I put fever plus symptoms into a slightly different category than just symptoms alone. But the message that I think shuls need to get out, schools need to get out to the balabatim, to the mispalim, to the congregants, is that do not come. You don't have a chiyuv. In fact, it might be an isser for a person who's potentially contagious to other people to come to shul and daven and potentially spread a fatal disease to other members of the shul because they have a chiyuv or they feel that they can't miss minyan, etc. And Harav Willich Shlita will hopefully talk more about that. I think that's extremely important measure. We are never going to get the genie back in the bottle. There is already transmission that's unidentified. In California, there are a lot of cases now of unidentified transmission. In other words, the index case, the person who has COVID-19 has no idea how they got it. So there are people that are out there in the United States right now that have COVID-19, may or may not have symptoms. They probably do have symptoms, but they're not very sick. And we certainly know that a person with symptoms, even mild symptoms, can be contagious. So the first and most important eitzah for shuls is to inform the balabatim that it isn't the chiyuv. In fact, it's possibly an isser for you to go to shul if you're not feeling well and potentially have a contagious illness that other people may unfortunately be very, very horribly impacted from. The next thing that I think is something that shuls should look to is to make sure that there are adequate hand washing stations that can be good old water and soap. And Rulik Shlita can discuss any shilas that people might have with liquid soap on Shabbos or with the alcohol dispensers that are used, the non-soap and water dispensers that are used on Shabbos. But certainly on a weekday, I feel very comfortable saying there are no halachic shilas. And Rulik will discuss whether he feels that there are any Shabbos shilas, Yontif shilas in regards to this coming up with the Pesach. And shul should make sure that those are well stocked and that they're filled and not empty, and that you have non-Shabbos started. You don't need to be automatic. There can be things that you press that don't involve any melacha, stations in appropriate places by entrances to the shul and to various places in the shul so people can wash their hands. It should be stressed that you shouldn't be coming to shul if you're coughing into your hands, if you're sneezing into your hands. It should be stressed that people should try to limit contact with all sorts of potentially contaminated surfaces, and that the cleaning staff in the shul should, as best as possible, try to regularly clean those staffs. Larger shuls may have cleaning staffs, smaller shuls may not. As best as possible to clean the high-touch areas with regular, routine, household, or easily purchasable cleaning equipment, Lysol, anything, the routine stuff, any product. There's no product that's really better than the others. For the soaps, you don't need antibacterial soap. Regular soap works just as well. And to teach people that they should wash their hands with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. If they go longer, there's no problem. If they go shorter, you may not clean it as well. In terms of teaching shul members proper coughing and sneezing etiquette, the best way is to sneeze into a tissue and then deposit the tissue, or cough into a tissue and deposit that into a garbage pail right away. Don't leave it hanging around on extenders and in tables and all sorts of places. That's horrible. But these are things that are common sense, but sometimes they need to be reminded. Shuls need to tell people this, and sometimes common sense isn't as common as we would think it is. And that's the best way, and then wash your hands. Alternatively, don't sneeze into your hands. Either sneeze onto the floor with no interruption between you and the floor as possible, or sneeze into your elbow. And again, wash hands. If you touch your face, if you touch other areas that are potentially contaminated, a person should try to wash his hands without ridiculously becoming obsessive compulsive and washing every 2 minutes. When you touch something that's potentially contaminated, go wash your hands and try to make sure before you wash your hands that until you get a chance to wash your hands, you try not to touch your mouth, your nose, your eyes, because that's the way that this can be transmitted. People that are sick probably are expelling contagious virus into the air around them within a 6-foot radius, and then those particles stay suspended in the air for a short period of time, sometimes a slightly longer period of time, and then they'll land on various things within this, the radius of that person. Just walking into that radius or just coming into contact with such a patient for a very short period of time probably poses no risk. Another thing that I've been asked multiple times already is, I know somebody who was in quarantine, and I spoke with them last week. Am I at risk? I shook their hand last week. They're now in quarantine, and they're asymptomatic. They have absolutely nothing wrong with them. So as far as we know, the best scientific evidence available today says that a person who is asymptomatic, and it's been several days since you've been in touch with them, and they're still asymptomatic, you probably have zero risk. Now, if they're asymptomatic this morning, and you touch their hands, and they're symptomatic in the afternoon, they theoretically could have been already contagious when they were asymptomatic. We do not know. There are no data yet available on can asymptomatic transmission really occur, and if so, how long can a person be asymptomatic and still transmit virus? Many viruses are potentially transmissible a short period of time before the symptoms begin. Chickenpox is a classical example of that. Highly contagious in the 12-hour period of time, maybe even 24-hour period of time before the skin rash appears. We do not know if that's true for COVID. It certainly is a possibility. But most of the transmission probably occurs in either mildly or moderately or severely ill patients. And those are the contexts that you need to be most concerned about. And again, when you do come into contact with such a person, whether you're taking care of such a person in your house as a caregiver or in any other situation, the best thing that you should do is wash your hands. Patients who are sick should wear a mask. Those are the only patients who should wear a mask. Healthy people in routine general life, as opposed to doctors going into an isolation room, healthy people at this point in time absolutely should not be wearing masks. People in your shul shouldn't be wearing masks. Anybody wearing a mask in shul should be asked, how come you're wearing a mask? If you're sick, you should be going home. The only possible exception that I can think to that would be a person who maybe never recently had a bone marrow transplant or some very, very severe immunocompromising situation, and that person would be wearing a mask 5 years ago, 2 years ago, under any circumstance to prevent even the slightest chance of them picking up something. And nobody should be coming into shul wearing masks if they're healthy. I don't think that's a good idea, and we don't recommend that. It's not a CDC recommendation, and I think it just causes panic and concern. And one of the things that we want to do is try to minimize the panic while we elevate the vigilance and while we make sure that everybody is aware of everything that they can possibly do. I had sent in to Rabbi Hauer, and we had sent out to our shul, and many other shuls have sent it out. I put together a frequently asked questions list. And Anybody's welcome to use that. We used it for our employees here at the hospital. I modified it a little bit for a shul, and anybody who wishes to use it, Rabbi Hauer or someone can send it out, and it's perfectly fine. Just please mention that this was used at the hospital if you're going to use it exactly verbatim. Give the hospital credit. A couple of other questions that routinely come up. I don't want to take away the more important time from our Willig Shlita, and I'll be available to answer any questions that people have specifically for me. A number of questions that I've been asked already have been regarding weakened immune system patients. I would define this, for example, as an 85-year-old person in your shul who has significant underlying respiratory disease. They have chronic lung disease of some nature. Should they be going out into public gatherings? So at this point in time, I would say that that really would be up to the individual. Before COVID-19, the same exact question would be asked. This isn't a COVID-19 question. This is a question that that patient should discuss with their physician. Is it dangerous for me to go out into the public? Influenza, unfortunately, heaven forbid, can also kill such people. And just to put things in perspective, there have been 30,000 deaths in the United States this flu season. From October to now, 30,000 people in the United States have died from flu. With COVID, unfortunately, we've now seen a number of deaths all related to one place in Washington, the state, and that's all been in a nursing home where there has been an outbreak. There have been no other deaths in the United States other than in that very debilitated population. So this is a critically important fact for people to remember. And each such patient, an elderly patient with severe lung disease or other immunocompromised patients, should discuss with their physician what is the best recommendation. I can't give a blanket recommendation, say, do not ever go to shul, do not go into public. If an individual is so concerned or their physician is so concerned, so then that's appropriate. A similar question is asked to me, what should we do about shul kiddushes, shul davening, shul shiurim? At the present time, my recommendation is that since we're recommending that people who are sick should stay home, and we're recommending that anybody who has been in contact with a COVID-19 known case and had a significant exposure self-quarantine, so that means that theoretically the other people there are at a low risk of spreading COVID-19. And at this point in time, and I stress, what I'm mentioning today is right now. It may change in updates a day from now, a week from now, a month from now. So everybody has to be aware that they have to be current on this information to be able to provide the best advice to your congregations, to your community. And in this situation, I do not recommend that shuls not have kiddushes. I do not recommend that shuls not have functions. I stress, I do not recommend that they change in a major way. If a shul chooses or wishes to do so in a particular area where there is a very high caseload, for example, in New Rochelle, the recommendations might be a little bit different. And I know the fact that it's in one shul in one day, Baruch Hashem, Mikam Chisol, we are such big Balei Chesed, and we go to different shuls, and we do all sorts of things, and we mix at Simchas, and at Nebuch, things that aren't Simchas. So there is potential for spread in our communities, maybe more than in some other communities. But I think that each shul has to make their own policies if they go beyond, above and beyond what the general CDC recommendations and some of the ideas that I touched upon. And in that situation, there may be a need to change. I've been asked multiple times about handshakes. So at this point, the CDC doesn't recommend that people do not handshake, albeit many have recommended such. And I think that's an individual decision for a rav to make for a shul. And if a shul were to say, we think it's best that people do a fist bump or just bow to each other, bang elbows together instead of handshaking, I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. For me to say publicly that every shul should do that, I think it's still premature. I've been asked a number of times about mikvah protocols. I've spoken with a number of mikvahs. I think the standard cleaning procedures in a mikvah, when you do not have a known case or an exposed self-quarantined patient coming to the mikvah should be told that if people have respiratory illness, they shouldn't be coming to the mikvah. And if they need to still come to the mikvah, I'm talking about for men, where they don't have the chiyuv to go to the mikvah, and for women that do have an obligation to go to the mikvah, then special arrangements should be made that maybe they should be the last person to go to the mikvah. I'm talking about when they just have a respiratory illness. I don't think the waters need to be cleaned differently than the regular standard ways that we clean the mikvah. After the last person is left who has the respiratory illness, the mikvah should be just cleaned in the regular way. If the person truly is very sick, they probably shouldn't be going to the mikvah, at least not that night. And then in terms of anybody who is self-quarantined, I'll let Harav Willick sleep the paskin. From a medical point of view, we do not recommend that they leave their house and do anything that is not life-threatening or life-saving. They go to the hospital, but that's pretty much it. They go to their doctor if they have to, and that's pretty much it. And they should certainly be wearing a mask. And the routine cleaning protocols for the mikvah, I think, will be fine for the water. I don't think this is transmitted via the water. And just the routine cleaning of the touch surfaces that a person might come into contact in the mikvah should be fine. There's an awful lot more that I could talk about this, but I think I've used up my half hour, and I'll turn this over to Rav Willick Shlita, and I'll stay on and obviously answer any questions that are appropriate for me rather than Rav Willick Shlita. Thank you very, very much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Dr. Glad. We really appreciate your insight. At this time, we're going to be asking Rav Willick Shlita to share with us from a halakhic perspective and the related questions as it relates to the coronavirus.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi Dr. Glatt. I only have one correction. Rabbi Glatt said that if someone has in quarantine and they endanger someone else, it may possibly be prohibited for him to go out. I disagree. It's certainly prohibited. Anyone who is contagious must stay at home and follow the guidelines of the local health authorities. We are never allowed to be more lenient than the local health authorities. We may be more strict than them, but never more lenient than them. Notwithstanding the fact that some doctors are somewhat skeptical, we follow the Dina de Mahusa. If the government says you're in quarantine, you're in quarantine, and you're not allowed to go out, as the doctor just said a minute ago, for anything which is not life-saving. This includes going out for the Megillah, going out for Pasher Zochos, includes going out to the Mikvah, even the most important religious rituals and requirements. Nothing is more important than the Kuach Nefesh and saving lives. And therefore, a person should stay home and not go to shul, not go to mikveh, as long as the person has been confirmed having this terrible disease. Now, there are differing opinions even within the health authorities about those who are not directly confirmed. They were in the same room, the same building, the same school, the same shul. You have to follow the local authorities. You can only be more strict than them, not be more lenient than them. Even if a different authority has a more lenient position, you have to follow the local authority. At least, that's a minimum. If you want to follow a strict authority, that's your right, but not less than the local authorities allow. I wanted to discuss a few of the upcoming issues, just to spell it out more directly. Pasha Zohar, Pasha Zohar Doraisa is infinitesimally insignificant compared to saving one life. And therefore, even if it is Doraisa or not Doraisa, it doesn't make a difference. You can hear it, Pasha Kitseitse, you can hear it when you get better. We don't take these things into account when it comes to saving lives. If a person is in the house, and Pasha Zohar, once you read from a Chumash, can't hurt. But that's about it. When it comes to the Megillah, same thing. No matter how significant it is, you're not allowed to leave the house. You want to read the Megillah yourself if you have your own class? That's wonderful. That's a great thing. If you don't have your own class, have Shech B'Shlita give a talk. This is absolutely no alternative. Then we can rely on the Poskim, it's a minority view, that you can fulfill the mitzvah even the live transmission via microphone, so to a telephone, so to a Zoom, a video conference, whatever. It has to be live, not a recording, obviously. Most Poskim don't accept that leniency, but the Shasat Chak is of this nature. That should be done. One may not leave the house. Now, there's been some discussions. I had some discussions with some people in the Office of Emergency Management of New York City, but there's just today a possibility exists, and pending the approval of the local authorities, if a person is quarantined in a house and someone else may not go into the house. You cannot either ain yotze ve'ain bo, can't go in, can't go out. But in certain circumstances, a person, as we heard before from Rabbi Dr. Glatt, 6 feet is the general distance, and someone said that's Dalet Amos, approximately, a very interesting, cute idea. It's possible for a person to come read the Megillah for a sick patient by staying outside the door, more than 6 feet away. The person can, if the authorities allow it, open the door, open the window, and have them hear from the outside. That is possible in a unique situation where it can be monitored appropriately. If the authorities prohibit that, it should not be done. Every local authority has to give a decision, because this question is certainly going to be asked in the coming week. The same thing applies to any other mitzvah or minhag, which is saying Kaddish, Someone told me yesterday that he was asked by a friend to say Kaddish, and he doesn't know Rochelle can't go out. But someone else can say Kaddish for you. As important as these things are, much more important is saving a life. I'm just going to reiterate again, because my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik always told us, in medical matters, don't ask the rabbi, ask the doctor. The rabbi is only here to confirm what the doctor says. If someone has a dispute among doctors, that causes a particular problem. Since I know Rabbi Glass for 45 years by now, as a trusted Talmud and colleague, I always go to him for any such question long before this particular crisis arose. And I go back to him again. Whoever calls me, I give him Dr. Glass' phone number. That's how my Rebbe taught us. You go to the doctors and ask them. Again, because of the particular public health issue involved over here, even if your doctor has a particular leniency, you may not follow it if the local authorities have a more strict view. This is my short reiteration of what Dr. Glass said. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Willig. There were a few shilas that have come up along the way throughout Rebbe's presentation that I was hoping to be able to ask, and if Rebbe could share any aras or thoughts. Is there a scenario where a person is in their home? Should people be trying to build minyanim in their own home that they are not able to go to shul?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because a person is not supposed to go into the house. No.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you. The next shaila that came up is in regards to nursing homes where there is no current knowledge of any COVID-19. There are a lot of people who like to do chesed and who like to bring mishloach manos, those types of things. Should all of those types of activities as it relates to nursing homes and buildings of the like, should that be avoided this year even without any knowledge of disease?
I think that's a glad answer to that question before. You can correct me if I'm wrong. That the assumption is that people who are not symptomatic and have no exposure are healthy. Now, he did say that someone who was in a nursing home, old or compromised, is a greater danger if they are exposed. So, of course, a person who thinks even the remote chance that he or she himself or herself is exposed, they should not walk into a nursing home. But if the person is confident that they are healthy, to my understanding, they can walk in because they're not going to make anyone else sick. And the people there, if you're not sick, are not going to get sick. But again, if the local authorities say different, you have to follow them.
Okay. Thank you. Just two more shilas as of now.
Yeah, sure.
There is a shul that does not prepare accordingly to have hand sanitizer available, and the only ones that are available are battery-operated, should those be avoided on Shabbos under the circumstances?
It seems to me that since there's a possibility of danger, if there's no other alternative, I would think there should certainly be alternative. There should be soap and water at the very least, and I'm told you use cold water, so it's not a Shabbos problem. But if nothing else in theory is available, I would say given the circumstances, one may even use a battery or an electric-operated sanitizer. However, they should try to use what we call a shinur. Instead of putting on the normal way, you put it on with the back of your hand.
Okay, excellent. Another shaila that came up is that there are some people who live in Florida for much of the winter, and around this time of year, maybe this question is for the doctor as well, around this time of year, people often return to New York. Should they stay put in Florida, or should they be coming back to the New York area?
Obviously, one cannot give a one answer to that question. Some people just decide they want to come up, going home for Purim. So without a mental Pesach, I think a mental Shavuot, there's no compelling cause to come into an area where there is some significant danger, especially the older people who are at greater risk. And Florida is a beautiful place. People have social reasons to come back. You know, they want to be with their kids. That, to me, is not a sufficient reason to put yourself at risk. Of course, if there is no significant risk, we don't want to make a panic and prohibit people from going from Florida to New York. So it's a personal decision, and I think the guiding principle should be if there is any risk.
Okay. Another shiloh that just came up through email is how to perform the mitzvah of machatzis ha-shekel, where everyone typically is picking up the same exact collection of coins, and in large shuls you could be talking about hundreds of people. Does it have to actually be that those coins are picked up? And if so, what's the best way to do that under the circumstances?
We should not do the machatzis ha-shekel at all. People have come at home, they have their own half dollars, they can use quarters, they can use dollar bills. It's only a minute. You're not going to sacrifice public health for a minute.
Okay. A bunch of shilas have come in regards to the consistency of the hand sanitizer. Some of them have more of a gel consistency and some more liquidy. And what would be the appropriate way to navigate that on Shabbos?
Well, the ones that I know, for example, like Purell, are certainly no problem. It's quite liquidy. If something is considered to be a gel, there is a potential problem, what we call mamachek. Shlomo Zalman has a kula, which many agree with, some disagree, but we can certainly rely on it in a pinch. But if you see to it that the entire cream or gel that you're using is totally absorbed within the skin, and there's no recognizable surface above the skin, that is permissible in all circumstances. So we try to avoid that, but in such a circumstance, it's permissible to rely upon.
Okay. The next question that came in is in regards to using things like Lysol wipes on Shabbos that are, of course, saturated with the appropriate chemicals. Can that be used on Shabbos?
Again, that's a chita problem, which is a much more serious halachic problem. If there's no alternative, and it's a question of chashas pikuach nefesh, of course, it's okay. If there's an alternative, it should be utilized. Once again, if there's no alternative, it's a health issue. One should try to do it machinally. In other words, instead of holding the Lysol wipe between your thumb and your index finger, as you might normally do, turn it around between the second and third finger backwards or something like that. That's called a shina, which is permissible in such a circumstance.
Okay. Another shaila that just came in, if someone is quarantined, should they be involved in hearing davening or kriyas haTorah at shul when they are davening at home?
I'm not sure what the question is.
If someone is davening at home because they're not feeling well,
right,
they're one of the people who are quarantined, is there any toelis in them listening to kriyas haTorah in shul or other aspects of davening?
You mean on a microphone, on a telephone hookup?
Yeah, like on a telephone, oh. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it can't hurt, but we believe it's a chobas atzibra. That's where it's much more lenient than Megillah or Parshas Zachim. That's where Meshach the Shlita, there was questions only about those two. Because we assume that Kriyas HaTorah is a chobas atzibra, the person's potter not allowed to come join the tzibra. So then he wants to hear it, but no harm, but need not make any extra effort to do so.
Okay. I think for the last question, this question is for Rabbi Dr. Glad. One of the questions that has come up a couple of times here is the best way for institutions and organizations to make sure that their buildings are clean and as well that their homes are clean. I think you mentioned, Dr. Glad, that some of the over-the-counter products would be sufficient. Is that true under all circumstances of someone who's otherwise healthy as well as for someone who knows that they have COVID-19?
So I think that the evidence at this point suggests that COVID-19 is not a more difficult to eradicate virus than other viruses or other bacteria. It doesn't have spores. Organisms that have spores are much more difficult to eradicate. And I would assume, although we don't have perfect data, that the regular standard cleaning products are probably going to be perfectly effective for the cleanings that we do in a house. In a hospital, we use always a slightly higher grade Seidel type of equipment, but the typical products that you have in your store should be fine. If somebody is in a unique situation where they have Rahman al-Litzlan, a bone marrow transplant recipient that has no immune system, and that situation, they should speak with their physician as to any additional recommendations that the physician might give to make sure that the house is as safe an environment as possible.
Okay, understood. I think those are the majority of the questions that have come in. I see that there are still a number of others that are in the queue. I think at this point we're going to have to wrap up as it's been 45 minutes or so. I'd like to thank you both very much, Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Dr. Glad, for your insights, for your halachic guidance, and for the medical guidance. If you have continuing questions that relate to the medical world, please make sure to speak to the appropriate medical professionals within your networks. Any halachic shaylas, hashkafa shaylas, please speak to the postgim in your communities. And as well, for the three organizations that are involved here, the OU and the RCA and the NYU, if there are any ways in which we can be of help, please, of course, feel free to reach out. And Mir Tashem, everyone should stay safe and have a really beautiful and meaningful Purim. Thank you all very much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.